This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Carol Masser, along with Paul Sweeney, live here on Bloomberg Business Week. Well, one of the market stories today is casino stocks. It's on the move in part because of expectations that folks will be able to head back to Macau despite spikes in COVID in that city. Well, Paul, we know China's slowly finding its way back post-COVID. Asia overall is welcoming back travelers, but now there's a new obstacle to deal with, and that's all in a story that you can find online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. It's also on the Bloomberg Terminal. So let's get to it. Let's bring in Bloomberg News senior reporter Sid Philip, joining us as we speak on the phone from London. Sid, good to have you here with Paul and myself. Tell us what's going on.
Thank you for having me. So at the moment, global airlines are now sort of bringing back their fleets to Asia, because for almost 3 years, airlines couldn't really fly to Asia. And now with restrictions lifting, people are talking about bringing back flights, but there is a major problem, and that is the closed-off Russian airspace. And given the fact that Russia stretches from tip to tip, from the tip of Eastern Asia to Europe, it's a crucial link
yeah.
that links both East and West.
So when I started reading your story, I had to literally go find an old-fashioned globe because the Google Maps wasn't doing it for me. I mean, like you mentioned, a couple things I learned. The former USSR, it's big. Russia's a big country, number one. And number two, for a lot of places, it's right smack in the middle between Europe and Asia. So that's a problem. How do some of these airlines, for lack of a better term, get around it?
So they literally have to get around it. And so a lot of carriers that are flying to Japan from Europe have been sort of skirting Russia via Kazakhstan and Mongolia. And that's adding several hours to their flights.
And it's also a cost issue, I would think, because, I mean, fuel is not cheap here. So are the airlines, are they finding it economically worthwhile, or are they just maybe not adding as much capacity as they typically would?
So it's a bit of both. I mean, obviously, fuel is a major expense, and it is the biggest expense for airlines. And since fuel is so much so expensive at the moment, airlines are really sort of weighing in whether or not they should operate those flights. And that's why we haven't seen a rush of airlines rapidly adding capacity to Asia, as one would expect when travel resumed.
You know, Sid, what I love about your story is the specificity that you include, and you talk about Japan Airlines. They fly to London from Tokyo via Alaska and Greenland and over the Atlantic to the British capital instead of Siberia, which adds up to 3 hours of flight time each way. That's serious. And I think about, you know, you say it's not just the extra time, it's not just the fuel, but you're talking about substituting aircraft, you know, increased crew hours, you know, you're blocking off seats to allow the aircraft to fly longer with lighter loads. There's so many issues, and I think this is part of one of those bigger macro trends as we see the pushback, whether against globalization because of geopolitical factors or what have you. Like, it is increasing the cost for so many different companies and industries.
Absolutely, and it's also having a major impact on carriers like Finnair. So Finnair spent years building a hub in Helsinki, and they connected Northern Asia with Europe and the U.S., and their eastbound network has been decimated by the closure of Russian airspace. I mean, the Polar route, which Finnair flew, was among the shortest routes from North Asia to Europe, and that's now closed off. And so they've had to circumnavigate Russia, and they've had to sort of seriously decide which flight they're going to operate.
So what's this done, or what do the airlines think this will do to demand here? Because on the one hand, gee, do I want to add another 3 or 4 hours to what's already a really long flight and maybe pay a higher ticket price? But, boy, if I haven't been to Japan for 3 years, I got to think the demand's huge.
Absolutely, and that's a very big challenge for airlines because they're going to have to work out which routes still work, which still are profitable, and where they need to sort of change frequencies from the daily service to a couple of times a week, whether they need to add stops, whether they need to add another leg to make the math work. And it's all sort of very well choreographed at the moment, and they have to sort of figure it out as demand gets back because, as you mentioned, demand is very strong at the moment.
Well, and so the other thing is, you know, the pushback against globalization, these geopolitical tensions, all of a sudden, you know, the bedfellows of past are no longer the bedfellows of today. And I think about, you talk about Middle East carriers, those state owners have refrained from sanctioning Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. So they have access, right, over Russian territory. So that's a plus for those Middle Eastern carriers.
Absolutely. It's a plus for the Middle Eastern carriers. It's also a plus for Air India, which is recently privatized. I mean, India hasn't taken sides in this conflict, and as a result, Indian airliners are continuing to overfly Russia, and that's helping them sort of connect the world as well as sort of bring in services that other rivals can't do.
So, Sid, how long do you think is this issue going to last? Is this just this is going to be an issue until the war ends, or is there any possibility that, you know, there could be some kind of negotiation amongst various countries to maybe open up some of the airspace?
So it's a very tricky question because at the moment it's a tit for tat. So Russian airliners are banned from European, Canadian, US airspace. And sort of Russia has imposed these sort of bans on those carriers from those countries. And so we really have to see how things go. Although on the other hand, we have seen some carriers which haven't been constrained by the sanctions and restrictions on flying across. We've seen, so in recent days, Cathay Pacific has talked about bringing back service on that route as well.
But it does make you wonder, you know, is this just, again, we're going to look back at this in a few years' time and say this is when the world started to be divided up in a different way. I mean, what are you hearing from those folks in the global airline industry? Is this just a temporary blip? And do they anticipate that things will go back to the way they were? Or no, this is something much more significant. You talk about the energy market and people are saying, no, things are shifting, especially when you look at Europe specifically as a result of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. What does the global aviation industry say?
So the global aviation industry, again, because everyone's got different sort of perspectives and every carrier has a different scenario. So it's a bit mixed at the moment. But yes, I mean, as long as this conflict lasts and as long as sanctions remain and as long as bans on airspace remain, it is going to be a challenge that airlines will have to figure out closely along with the governments and of the countries that they represent.
All right, Sid, that's good stuff. Really appreciate it. Sid Phillips, senior reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
You know, Paul, this story definitely jumped out at us. It's among the most read on the Bloomberg, and with just about a week to go until the midterm elections here in the U.S., Bloomberg Business Week national correspondent Josh Green is writing in a Bloomberg Opinion column about how Democrats hate Elon Musk, but that he might actually be their savior. I mean, that's just one reason why it caught our attention.
Yes, exactly.
Josh is also author of Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. And Josh Green with us on the phone in Washington, D.C. Hey, Josh, great to have you here with Paul and myself. Walk us through your thinking here in your Bloomberg Opinion column about Elon Musk, Democrats not liking him, but that he actually could be good for them.
Yeah, well, if you spend any time on political Twitter, you know, which I do and most people in Washington do, one of the things that's really jumped out over the last year or so is this growing Democratic antipathy for Elon Musk, who's kind of revealed himself over the last year or so through his kind of Twitter actions as being like really a kind of a right-wing meme-tweeting conservative who likes to kind of troll and provoke liberals and has made a lot of noises about, you know, maybe reversing Donald Trump's lifetime ban. And you know, his takeover of the company, which I think a lot of people didn't think was going to happen, now that it has, I sort of looked at what effect that might have on politics. And this all ties back to a piece that I'd done for Business Week, the Year Ahead issue back in January, where I went out and asked a bunch of smart political strategists, like, what might it take for Democrats to hold on to the House in the midterm elections? And I think the single most interesting answer I got was from a Republican strategist who said, you know what it would be? It would be if Twitter let Donald Trump back on to his account. That could be a potential game changer for Democrats. And now here we are, what, 10, 11 months later, and seems like the likelihood of that is pretty high. It's too late to, I think, to affect the midterm elections next week. But as far as the lead up to the 2024 presidential election, if Donald Trump gets back on Twitter, I think that could change the ballgame for Democrats.
And Josh, I guess just to take thinking a little bit further, is that simply because that would galvanize Democrats against a higher profile messaging from Donald Trump?
Yeah, there's two reasons, really. Number one, Donald Trump galvanizes everybody. He galvanizes Republicans. He galvanizes media folks, but he really galvanizes Democrats. If you look at the best election the Democrats have probably had in the last 10 years, it was the 2018 midterm elections. We saw a record turnout. Obviously galvanized them again in 2020 when Joe Biden got elected. But since Trump has been off the ballot, there really isn't that kind of catalyst that unifies Democrats to go out and vote. I think it's one of the problems they may wind up having next week. The other reason that Trump is so important is that if you go and look at what's called revealed preference polling, it's when pollsters and political scientists go out and say, you know, we know you support this whole laundry list of issue positions, but what are the things that actually motivate you to go out and vote? You may be against gun control, but maybe you wouldn't get off the couch and go vote based on that issue. Well, in the long laundry list of issues that these pollsters have, impeaching Donald Trump was the number two issue out of about 80 issues in the 2020 election.
Wow.
It ranked only behind taking immigrant children away from their parents. So this is something that not only unites liberals and Democrats, but is something that activates them to go out and vote. So you can imagine if Trump were back on Twitter, tweeting all the time, all over cable news, back the way it used to be, that is painful and annoying as that would be for a lot of Democrats, it might actually redound to their political benefit in 2024.
So, Josh, in all your reporting, you know, and watching the election cycles and the unusual cycles that we've certainly had in the last couple of years, it feels like are the most recent couple of election cycles. Are voters, is that it, that they are more likely to come out and vote against something and someone versus voting for someone?
I think that's basically right. If you look at the last decade or two of U.S. politics, so much of our politics is negative politics, negative motivation, the idea that, you know, I'm voting against the opponent's presidential candidate rather than voting in favor of my own. You just see more and more of that. And when you don't have that kind of galvanizing enemy on the ticket to motivate you to the polls, then I think what happens is what we're going to see next week, where voters kind of return to fundamentals. And the mm-hmm. fundamentals for Democrats are not good. Joe Biden has a low approval rating, inflation is skyrocketing, the stock market isn't doing well. All of those things historically add up to it being a poor election for Democrats. So they would love nothing better than, or at least the Democratic strategists privately would like nothing better than to have somebody like Trump out there taking everybody's attention away from the bad news,
right,
focusing it on him, because people are actually willing to base their votes on keeping him out of office. And that's the thing that Democrats are really missing this election.
So, Josh, what do we know from Elon Musk as it relates to, is he going to allow President Trump back on? And does President Trump want to come back on? One minute.
I mean, it sounds like he is. Bloomberg News had a story, reported story on Friday, based on a source with inside knowledge of Twitter and what Musk was going to do, that said Musk didn't like the idea of lifetime bans. And the
right.
story, or the source, specifically cited Donald Trump as an example of this. So
yeah.
Who knows with Elon Musk, right? Mercurial guy,
yeah.
But if he does let Trump off Twitter, I really do think that would change a lot of things in our daily lives and in our daily political lives.
Josh, 20 seconds really quick. Is this a different Donald Trump? Would he be as influential as he was before? And just really quickly.
Yep, same guy. I don't think Donald Trump is ever going to change, and I don't think the media is going to change in the way they cover him either. So I would expect the influence to skyrocket if he gets back on Twitter.
Well, so good that we can count on something yes. in this unusual and volatile world. Josh Green, national correspondent at Bloomberg Business Week. Check out his Bloomberg Opinion column. It is on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com. Check out at Joshua Green at on Twitter. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Our desk sharing with us that President Biden did speak today with President-elect Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of Brazil, offering his congratulations on the election. During that call, the president, President Biden, commending the strength of Brazilian democratic institutions following free, fair, and credible elections. This was another one, very close, where the sitting president wasn't ready to kind of give the election or say
exactly.
To respect
looking at the numbers, kind of jumped out of you. Lula got 50.9% to Bolsonaro's 49.1%. I mean, it just seems like everywhere around the world, it's evenly divided. You know, you think about the UK as
yep.
well. It's just amazing here. So this is a developing story, but fascinating, certainly.
Well, and I have to say, this was one of the stories definitely following over the weekend, the result of the Brazilian presidential election. Really dramatic comeback for the left-wing politician. So let's talk about the significance of this, as we are definitely living in interesting political times globally. Bloomberg New Economy editorial director Eric Schatzker, watching the globe and developments. He is back with us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. This was another interesting political development, to say the least.
Well, sure.
And not unexpected necessarily.
No, the polls in Brazil were suggesting that Lula was going to pull it out, but as we've learned here in the United States and in so many other parts of the Western world, at least, polling isn't always reliable anymore.
Right.
But as it turned out, Lula did pull out the victory with a small margin that the polls suggested he might. The reason I find this so fascinating is because there are many. Let's just put it this way. There's a temptation to say that Lula's election is a repudiation, right, by Brazilians of the things that Bolsonaro stood for. Mm-hmm. The questioning of institutions, mm-hmm. right? The challenge, the similar challenges that we hear here in the United States to the accuracy and efficacy of the voting system. The doubts shed on the solidity, if you will, of democracy. And the truth of the matter is that that's not the case for two reasons. The first is that this was an awfully close vote.
Right.
Right? Bolsonaro supporters, gave him 49% of the vote, and Lula supporters gave him 51% of the vote. And, of course, there isn't an official concession yet, so it ain't over. And the second thing is that for that very reason, there are many in Brazil who doubt, clearly because they came out in support of Bolsonaro, who doubt some of the things that he claims to doubt as well. And that's not to say that either side is correct.
Right.
Of course, it's a very muddy picture, and Lula doesn't exactly have the most sterling of histories himself. But it does say that just as this country is, Brazil is fighting an internal battle.
Yep.
And there are deep misgivings in Brazil about the direction of the country and what it takes to generate not just economic growth, but inclusive growth and what we might call sustainable growth. They use some of the very same language in Brazil. And these questions, as this vote demonstrates, are very difficult
to
resolve.
When will it become a problem that Bolsonaro has not conceded? I mean, I'm not familiar with Brazilian politics, but if this goes on more than a day or two or three, does that suggest that there's going to be a significant, I don't know, court fight or something along those lines?
Well, some of his allies in government have effectively conceded already,
okay.
said things to the effect of, you know, we should not question the will of the people. And so there isn't unanimity on the Bolsonaro side that we're not going down without a fight along the lines of January the 6th
right.
here in the United
right.
States. Does that guarantee that there's going to be a peaceful transfer of power? No, but we'll have to wait to see what kind of support Bolsonaro can muster for that type of effort, not just the election effort. That's fine. We would expect all of his allies to be solidly behind him in the election. But when it comes to challenging the results of the election, as we've seen here, it requires a lot more than that. And it does, again, as we've seen, require something of a plan.
Well, that's what I was going to say, right? Okay, next step, fiscal policy, right? A credible fiscal policy.
Well, and we may be waiting for that for a long time.
Right.
Lula is, by all accounts, perhaps even by his own account, a populist politician. You know, the Bolsa Mensual, which is the monthly stipend that they give to poor Brazilians,
mm-hmm.
was something that he and his successor Dilma celebrated, and which Bolsonaro subsequently, you know, took full credit for as well, because it became critical during the that intense peak of the pandemic, when so many people in so many parts of the world were struggling, not least of which was taking place in Brazil. But again, he's a populist, and
yeah.
so and doesn't have the most credible of records when it comes to forming solid fiscal policy.
It's just fascinating, though, and we just got a few seconds, but this whole, you know, it was a close race. Like, so just
exceedingly
as you said,
close.
It's not a case of a landslide and everybody was all in Lula, and that says something a lot about what's going on. Eric, thank you so much. You got a full plate. I know we're not going to see you for a couple of weeks because you got NEF in Singapore coming up.
That's
so
right.
Lots of global issues that they're going to be tackling. You can find out more, certainly, at Bloomberg and on the Bloomberg terminal. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
Keep driving crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Love the tunes you guys have on the show. It's always...
We got the cool stuff.
I know. I missed the...
Dave Wilson.
Yeah, I missed that. We need to bring
we'll
it
bring
up
it
occasionally.
Out
all right. First 9 months of the year, let's forget about it. I mean, stocks down mid-20s, bonds down low teens. So we had a little bit of a bump here in mm-hmm. the month of October. We'll take that. The question is, where do we go from here? And what's going to be the drivers to move this market forward one direction or the other? Let's check in with somebody who does this stuff for a living, J.J. Kinahan, Chief Executive Officer of IG North America, joining us on the phone from Chicago here. So, J.J., thanks so much for taking the time here. October's been pretty good for equity investors here. Should we get used to it or kind of get back to the old ways?
I don't think you should necessarily get used to it. It's a pretty amazing month, you know, as you guys have reported many times. Looks like it's going to be the best Dow month since 1976. Nice. That all said, it's a great breath of fresh air, if you will. But the earnings season, which so far has been pretty good, I think also has given us some forward-looking statements that may make us a little bit more nervous, and it may be until January and February where we start to see some of those things come home to roost, if you will.
Yeah, remember when like bad news was good news because it meant the Fed was going to keep rates low? We're in a different environment, and even if we get some bad news, right, we're going to get that monthly jobs report, JJ, on Friday. The Fed has been pretty clear that it's going to continue raising rates. We're not done yet. What does that mean for the earnings outlook for publicly held companies?
Absolutely. And, you know, Carol, obviously we have this week an 87% probability of a 75% rate hike.
Right.
I think we've already kind of built that in. But, you know, you saw companies like Procter & Gamble come out with incredible earnings, really 7% organic growth in a company of that size. Just amazing. But their CEO adds in their call, we expect that we're going to have slower growth. Because one of the reasons being strength of dollar, and you're starting to hear strength of dollar a lot more. And again, as you know, your listeners think about it, the rates going up make the dollar more valuable versus foreign currencies. So in an inflationary environment anyways, it means companies overseas are either going to have to find cheaper alternatives or do without or order less of these products. So once we start to see the demand side get hit, that's not a good thing. And as I said, I don't think you're quite seeing it yet. I think we may have to turn the calendar a year before we really start to see some of the ramifications. And that actually goes for all these interest rate hikes also. You know, it usually takes 6 to 9 months for these rate hikes to get through the system. So we haven't really, we're just starting to see, in my opinion, the beginning of some of the ramifications for the economy overall. I'm not doom and gloom by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think that you have to continue with a cautious note as we head into the year end.
Hey, JJ, we had a kind of a rough week in the world of technology stocks last week. We had some disappointing earnings from some of the stalwarts on the software side, like a Microsoft, which was a little cautious in its guidance. And then, of course, Meta and the other social media companies calling out weak advertising, which I guess shouldn't be a surprise with an economy going into a recession. But did that change your view of technology? Because it's been kind of a leading group for well over a decade now.
Yeah, you know, it's really pretty amazing how we've kind of gone from, it seems like the old guard, if you will, a little bit, is in charge. It's some of these Dow stocks that have done well. And I do have to say, I think all of, if I had said to you before last week, these are how the tech stocks are going to perform, you'd have thought last week would be a wreck. And instead, you had the Caterpillars and the Coca-Colas of the world coming through to save the day, if you will. And so I do think what's going to happen is we're going to have to perhaps find more leadership. And so for that, quite honestly, I look to the financial sector, which hasn't quite performed to the level I think many of us would have liked to. I think what we hope to see as the end of the year comes in the beginning of next year is a more normalizing of that yield curve where the, 10-year is trading over the 2-year. And I think with that, we can start to find the leadership that we've been looking for.
Right.
And the tech, let's face it, really hasn't provided us at all in the last couple of years.
JJ, how do you factor in, though, that it's a good chance that inflation stays not, doesn't go back down to maybe a 2% level, or the Fed funds rate doesn't go back down to 2%, but stays maybe around 4% or so, that is the new norm? Because as we continue to move forward, I keep hammering this because it just makes sense to me that we are living in a different environment in terms of geopolitical, supply chains, climate change, aging populations. All of these will have an impact and probably lead to strains on the system. So how do you think about that and investment strategy going forward?
Well, I think one of the things that you are seeing right now is sort of those dividend paying stocks. As I talked about, the old guard being more popular, at least in the near term, tends to be a little bit of an inflation hedge. Along with that, those who trade options using covered calls against it to enhance their returns seems to be something we're seeing quite a bit more of. And I think, as you talk about it, Kelly, there's just so much changing at once. What I would also say for people is as you invest right now, you may really want to think about being more of a partial rather than an all-in investor, because I would also say with that, the VIX is going to stay to a bit of an elevated level. Right now, the VIX trading about 26, telling you that you should expect about a 1.6% move every single day in the S&P 500. So people have, even if they're not trading these products, they have to understand what these products are telling them. And what the products are telling you right now is that as you look out toward the next 3 months, we should expect these 1.5% to 2% moves in the S&P 500 or the SPX on a daily basis.
So, JJ, just real quickly, what's your call on valuation? Your house is market valued.
It's really tough to say. Well, it's clearly fair value. I guess you would have to say that with all that is changing, if you're a believer in efficient market, you would say that it's always fairly valued. But so much is changing. I think you have to be very, very careful, especially to me. I guess the better way to look at it is when you're looking at these earnings calls, I use Procter & Gamble as,
right.
as an example earlier, but many, what are they saying going forward? Because
right.
that's really what you have to say is the valuation, and many of them you're going to have to discount
yep.
going forward because of that.
We need to know about outlooks and what kind of transparency yep. and visibility they've got. Hey, JJ, thank you so much. JJ Kinahan of IG North America.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.